This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. This is Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. It's a Friday. That means it's usually our Doctor in the House segment with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. But this time we have a different doctor in the house. Earlier this month, 19 Malaysians who were on a climb to the peak of Mount Elbrus in Russia were stranded after a severe mud flow. Mount Elbrus is Europe's and Russia's highest mountain. The mud flow also trapped about 300 tourists in the mountainous area of the Kabardino-Balkar Republic in the Russian Caucasus. Later, the authorities confirmed the Malaysian climbers who were affected were safely evacuated. But we wonder, what's involved in the preparation for such a treacherous climb? What are the health and safety concerns? Lee Chui Lin spoke to consultant emergency physician Dr. Alzamani Muhammad Idros about emergency medicine in high altitudes.
Trying to reach the peak of the tallest mountain on Earth can be a deadly task. The odds are stacked against you. With the cold, the lack of oxygen, the strong winds, the capricious weather, much can go wrong. So what can a doctor do against these odds? Taking us through emergency medicine at high altitudes today is Dr. Alzamani Idros, consultant emergency physician. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you were part of the Merdeka de Everest team. Let's talk about that experience. You know, what was that like?
First of all, thank you for inviting me here. It's my greatest pleasure to be able to talk on this subject. Many years ago, there was a group of Malaysians who wanted to climb Mount Everest. Actually, this is after the first successful climb. And they got together and they trained and they sort of asked if I could be the doctor at the base camp. And I was a young specialist graduate then in emergency medicine. And in our specialty, we are trained on high-altitude illnesses, emergencies at high-altitude illnesses. So I said, okay, I will join in. But they said they're not going to pay me. It's voluntary basis, but they will provide me the plane ticket and free accommodation under many stars in the tents. Somehow I was lucky. I was able to get permission to the place where I was working at. And I joined them. And along the way, part of the things that we did was also to really see the practice of emergency medicine on high altitude, as well as doing some research along the way.
And I understand that you're also part of an organization of doctors working at high altitudes. Is that correct?
Yes, correct, yes.
How did you come to be a part of that?
This organization is called International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation, or UIAA. Under UIAA, there is a medical committee. And I've been active in National Adventure Society in Malaysia, and this society is very active. I'm in the medical section of this society, and they asked if I'm interested to be part of this. When I came back from the Everest, I've got first-hand experience in handling high-altitude emergencies, acute mountain sicknesses, and I did some papers on that. And I accepted their nominations, and I was in this federation under the medical committee segment.
Of course, when you agreed to sign up for this, or to at least sign up for the climb to Everest, I can imagine all the reasons why. I mean, if someone invited me to go climb or at least ascend a little bit one of the tallest mountains in the world, of course I would go. But I imagine it needed a lot of preparation. How did you prepare both as a doctor as well as somebody who would also have to be doing the physical activity required to get to base camp?
On one hand, it's preparation for medical emergencies. On the other hand, the doctor himself is human and will be susceptible to high-altitude illnesses. So on that part, I trained with the team, but not as rigorous as the team, because my assignment was to be at the base camp. So I trained climbing local mountains, including Mount Kinabalu. In fact, we also trained in hypobaric chambers in the Sungai Besi Air Force camp. They have this chamber which could simulate the pressure at high altitude. So I went through all that, and having done that, I looked into medical preparation with the notion that there is no way we could have an ambulance arriving at the base camp if there is an emergency. There's no luxury of a hospital or emergency room which is well equipped up there. So we made some plans and tried to suit certain medications for all these emergencies, and also what to do should we need to bring injured climbers down.
So what were the kinds of services that you needed to provide for the team during that expedition? I'm sure that, you know, there were things that happened that you couldn't anticipate, but what did you think you needed to prepare for?
First, I need them to understand what they're up against when they climb mountains of this height. We have to give them talks on high-altitude illnesses, and this include acute mountain sickness, how they can get this sickness, what they can do to avoid getting them. Apart from educating them, I also prepared the relevant medications and the relevant equipments so that we'll be able to handle all kinds of high-altitude emergencies up there.
How did you plan the kinds of supplies and medication that needed to be taken along? Because, of course, I'm sure, you know, it's going to be somewhere between a first aid kit and the whole ER. You know, you want to be able to take everything. But, of course, you have to pick and choose.
Yes. I have to be, in a way, a drug economist because I had to be economical in the drugs that I prescribe. I kind of look at usually the number of climbers. Usually, we will get anything between 10 to even 50% of them being sick. So I need to prepare the medications depending on the number of climbers and to suit with the risk that they are up against. So the drugs that I prepare would be to cater for acute mountain sickness, snow blinds, things like that. And even emergencies such as a heart attack, for example, and also the common illnesses, which just anybody would be coming to your common clinics, flu, diarrhea, fever, muscle ache, and things like that. So using this predictive medicine, sort of to predict what they may get up there, this is how I base my preparation on. We do not have the luxury of ambulance, but we know that we need to be in contact with the helicopter providers, and we have to make sure all climbers are insured, including support climbers, so that we have a clear route as to how to bring them down in case of emergency. We also work closely with the Sherpa, and they are also working as porters, so some of our equipments and medications are brought along with them. As for me, I had my pouch bag and my backpack. I had limited supply of medicine because along the way, I had to be working as a street doctor. So if they're sick there and then, we will be able to actually provide the medication instantly. And in a way, if we are able to tackle early, we might be able to stop them from getting worse. And hence, they could still be part of the climbing team and not going down and losing them totally.
What are the differences between making emergency health decisions on the ground compared to when you're up at high altitudes? How does that change?
It's completely different ball game. On the ground, you have the streets, you have the ambulance team, you have the nearby clinics, the nearby hospitals. Up there, there's nothing. In fact, Everest Base Camp has the height of about 5,200 meters from sea level.
So it's already higher up than Mount Kay, for example, the peak of Mount Kay.
Yes, Mount Kinabalu, just to give you a perspective, it's about 4,100. Some people say 4,095, but it's about that, 4,100 meters. So it's about 1,000 meters higher. And this is an uninhabitable area. You just can't survive. So when you go up there, it's just for a short period of time. There's no greens, no food. So you have to bring things up there. Hence, we have to make do with what we have up there. That's the difference, because the teams, the people going up there, including doctors, are all susceptible to acute mountain sickness. So in preparation, we have not only to have the relevant medications ready, but also our team to climb up there safely, even if they are doctors. This is the difference. Actually, if we want to just have the bottom line solution to any medical emergencies related to high altitude illnesses, is to bring them down, where the pressure of oxygen on the sea level or the ground level or the lower level is much more. And we just can't press a lift button to go down. So going down will be going through all these terrains, all these crevices, and putting people at risk. So that's the difference. Not having ambulance which can just appear right in front of you, but here we have people who needs to bring you down, and these people too would be at risk of that. So the decisions may be risky not only for the people who are sick, but the people who are helping the sick ones.
I'm speaking today with consultant emergency physician Dr. Alzamani Idris. We're talking about emergency medicine at high altitudes, which Dr. Alzamani has experienced on basically the highest altitudes that humans can get to, Mount Everest. Up next, we find out more about acute mountain sickness as well as how a lack of oxygen affects the rest of our body. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. My guest is Dr. Alzamani Idris, consultant emergency physician, and we're talking about emergency medicine at high altitudes. We were discussing the process of ascending to base camp earlier, you know, and how things change. You've mentioned acute mountain sickness a number of times. Could you explain what that is? Is there a difference between acute mountain sickness and altitude sickness, for example?
When we talk about high altitude illness, is a broader term, and acute mountain sickness is one of those. So when one climbs at a height of beyond 2,000 meters, as low as 2,000 meters from the sea level, one would be at risk of getting this acute mountain sickness. And how one gets acute mountain sickness is, if I were to sum it all up, the mother of all problems that cause acute mountain sickness is the low level of oxygen in your body, what we term as hypoxia. So the symptoms that you would get usually be headache. That's the most common symptom. And if it gets worse, you may even get vomiting, and you may even get inability to sleep or insomnia. You won't be able to walk straight. And this acute mountain sickness can progress. In most severe terms, you can get your brain to be watery, or what we call a high-altitude cerebral edema. Your lungs also could be watery, and we call that high-altitude pulmonary edema.
Why does your body react by, you know, kind of pushing water into these areas or producing water? Why does that happen?
Yeah, this is the problem that you get when your body has a low level of oxygen or hypoxia. In a nutshell, when your body has a low level of oxygen or hypoxia, the vessel, the blood vessels throughout the body become dilated. They become bigger, except for the blood vessel in the lung, which becomes smaller. These are physiological change. This is what medical students learned in their first year of medical school. But the effect, when the blood vessels become big, you will have more blood flowing through the vessels. Hence, you will get increased pressure. It's just like having your rubber hose, your garden rubber hose. When there's more water flowing in, the pressure will be higher. On top of that, the low level of oxygen would cause these vessels to be leaky. So water can cross across the wall of the blood vessel. This coupled together, a high pressure and a leaky wall, it causes or pushes fluid to go out of this vessel, and hence you can get water in the brain, you can get water in the lung. You could even be drowning in your own lung because water filling up your lung, although you're not in water, so to speak.
So how would you treat that? Just hearing the idea of watery brains or watery lungs just sounds really frightening. Is it treated by drugs? Would it have been treated by procedure? Would it be different if you were in a hospital compared to at base camp?
Yes. This is a kind of a spectrum before it develops to the end spectrum. The end spectrum will be this watery brain, watery lungs, which would be deadly. But this spectrum starts with a simple, mild acute mountain sickness with a mere headache. So from headache, you start to develop vomiting, you start to have insomnia, and then you start to have hallucination, and you lose consciousness. This is pointing towards watery brain. Along the way, you got not only headache or insomnia and all this, but you also develop shortness of breath, difficulty to breathe. And this goes towards watery lungs. So the way we manage depends on where you are. If it is a mild acute mountain sickness, a simple Panadol is enough and for you to just rest at that level. But if you start to vomit, that is a very bad sign. If you start to vomit on the mountain, then you have to not only give painkiller in the form of Panadol or paracetamol, in what we call the drug, we also need to give drug what we call acetazolamide. it has a brand name. Wherever you go on mountain resorts, they call it Dymox, but it's a brand name. But it's actually the generic name, the actual name is astazolamide. This drug is required. Even when you develop watery brain or watery lung, you still need to use this. When you get watery brain, we have to add steroids. Or watery lung, we have to add steroids. For lungs, we can also add another drug, what we call nifedipine. This is to open up the blood vessel which has become smaller or constricted in the lung, as I explained earlier on.
I'm assuming that if this were to happen in, let's say, a hospital setting, you would have taken the time, however brief, officially diagnose this person with, you know, watery brains, watery lungs, etc. But up on the mountain, again, your diagnostic equipment is not there. How do you kind of make these decisions when you have an idea of what the diagnosis might be, but it's not confirmed by any other tests?
That's a good question. In fact, we all, clinicians, are trained to be able to make clinical diagnosis. When we say clinical diagnosis, it's a diagnosis which is not supported by blood investigations and so on and so forth. We don't have the proof of that. But the symptoms that patient presents, all these headache, nausea, vomiting, those form the clues for us to make this diagnosis. There are tools for us to make this diagnosis. For example, we have this Lake Louise questionnaire. You could Google this and you could get this set of questions whereby if you tick the symptoms that you have, it will point towards whether you are really having acute mountain sickness or not. So these are the tools. Earlier I told you about the medications, the drugs that would be useful. But the bottom line, if the actual definitive treatment for acute mountain sickness is oxygen, and up there, well, some people carry oxygen. There's a limit to how many oxygen tanks one can carry up there because it's heavy. But you need to come down and where the oxygen level and pressure is higher. And that would be the best cure for acute mountain sickness.
How long does it actually take the human body to acclimatize to such high altitudes? You know, what is that process of acclimatization like?
Yeah. Acclimatization. That's a word which carries an explanation. No one can fly to the base camp and survive longer than half an hour. Because if you fly direct to the base camp at 5,200 meters, you're not acclimatized. So you would develop this acute mountain sickness, watery brain, watery lung, anytime. But we see all the climbers, they climb and it takes some time before they could get to that level. For example, when I went to the Everest base camp through the Nepal side, it took me 9 days on foot, climbing about 5 hours on foot every day. And at a certain level, we have to sleep certain places for 2 nights, certain places for overnight. And this is the process of slow climbing. It's a process of acclimatization. Physiologically speaking, the way the body responds to low oxygen, we start to breathe faster. When we breathe faster, it's compensating because there's low oxygen out there and we are inhaling more frequent oxygen intake. So that should compensate the lack of oxygen. But as we do that, we are expiring or kicking out carbon dioxide. We take in oxygen, we kick out carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, by nature, is acidic. So, as a net effect, our body becomes alkali, and this gives instruction to the brain to tell the lungs to stop breathing too fast. And when you start to breathe slower, less oxygen intake, your body has a low oxygen level, and this causes all the, whatever I explained just now, right, mountain sickness. And when you climb slowly, according to what is recommended, what happens to the body is that the body, in a way, kicks out the alkali through the urine. The kidney has changed. It kicks out more alkali through the urine, causing the body to be in more acidic state, whereby this acidic state is the one which pushes us to breathe deeper and more frequent.
So are there risk factors that would determine whether you might potentially be at greater risk of acute mountain sickness or of altitude sicknesses in general?
Yeah, I would say the mountain is very fair to all human beings, because we do see more acute mountain sickness among those who are athlete fit.
And, that's unexpected.
Yeah, and young, compared to those who are elderly and old. And the reason is simple. The young and fit would climb the mountain faster. The elder ones would take their time. And the elderly would be better acclimatized compared to the young and enthusiastic ones. What the mountain's trying to tell us, hey, slow down, enjoy the journey and enjoy the scenery. Don't go too fast. And when you go too fast, you pay the price in getting this acute mountain sickness.
We've been talking about the lungs, the brain, and the symptoms specific to acute mountain sickness. But that isn't the only thing and the only risks that can occur when you climb a mountain. How do you deal with something, for example, as basic but as pervasive as the cold? I assume that things like hypothermia and frostbite would be of concern.
Yes. Up there, the Everest Base Camp, sometimes the temperature at night could go to as low as negative 20 degrees Celsius. That's below freezing point. So to protect yourself from coldness is important, because if your hands, your feet are exposed to this below freezing point temperature, basically it's as if you're putting your hands and your feet into that frozen segment of your fridge. When you do that, all the fluids in your hands, your feet will become frozen. There won't be blood flow. When there's no blood flow, the muscles of your hands, your fingers, your toes, they die. And this is when you develop gangrene. And it's not painful, but it will just come off by itself. We call it auto-amputation. We need to protect this by having good gloves. You need to have down jacket. Jackets, the good ones, they are made of goose feathers, and you could withstand better. And thermal gloves, and your boots need to be waterproof. If you are faced in such a situation, is to take yourself out of the cold environment, meaning get into your tent. You could actually put your hands under your armpit, where it's warmer, or in the groin. This is a temporary measure. But if need be, for someone who is exposed or at risk to getting gangrene, frostbite, we need to put the hands into warm water, about 40 degrees Celsius. And in fact, we need to circulate the water as the hands are soaked in the basin like that. I think during the last climb, we had one of our climbers had the first stage of frostbite. We call it frost nip. It could progress to frostbite, but that's what we did as a treatment. He got all the toes intact, thankfully.
So how does it progress? Because again, I'm guessing that since it's not painful, since it's so cold that everything's probably numb anyway, you might not notice that you're beginning to have these issues. How does it progress from frost nip to frostbite, resulting in auto-amputation?
Yeah. It can be painful, actually. What I meant by painless is the auto-amputation part. After the toes or the fingers die, then you don't feel it. Then it will just come off by itself. But the frostbite itself is painful. So the pain, the numbness, those are the things that actually point towards you getting the risk of this frostbite.
Aside from frostbite, there's also eyes. How does being up at high altitudes affect your eyes?
Yes. One of the risks up there is you can get two problems at high altitude as far as the eyes are concerned. One is what we call snow blind. Then the other is bleeding in the eye, what we call a high altitude retinal hemorrhage. Yeah? So first, the snow blind. At high altitude, the air is thinner. The sunlight reflected by the snow is actually very bright. The UV light that is reflected and gets into the eye actually burns the outer layer of the eyes, or what we call keratoconjunctiva. This burning of this outer layer of the eye by this bright UV light, which is not filtered by air at all, it causes severe pain and blindness. It's usually temporary, about 2 to 3 days, you won't be able to see, but it is very, very painful. Hence, you need very good sunglasses. The other one, the bleeding in the eye, this is again due to low level of oxygen. I've explained earlier that when there's a low level of oxygen in the body, the blood vessels would dilate, become bigger. It happens in the eyes, And when it becomes bigger, the pressure is higher in the blood vessel and it can bleed. The vessel in the eye would just bleed. So this is high altitude retinal hemorrhage. And you could be looking at people, the shape becomes distorted. And this may take months to recover. And in some people, you may get blindness, depending on which part of the eyes is bleeding.
So, I mean, we talk about all these different ways of preparation, but it can all be sidelined by poor hygiene. You could just get food poisoning,
yes,
and that could be, you know, a great difficulty. How do you deal with hygiene then when you're in an environment where the toilets are portable, drinking water is coming from snow, you're not showering? How do you cope with that?
Yes. Up there at the base camp, basically, you don't shower at all. If you stay there for 2 months, you would be having a single shower for 2 months. There is a makeshift toilet. Now, the Everest Base Camp is a place where people want to keep clean. So for the toilet, basically, they have a container. And this is where all the waste are kept. When it's full, it will be sealed and brought down. So as for the hygiene, water is the most important. You have to boil the water, the snow, and that becomes the source of water up there. So as long as you're able to boil the water, use boiled water, always keep your hands clean, that should be all right up there.
What are the health markers that need to be monitored while ascending to great heights? And actually, before we get to that, I mean, so can somebody get the symptoms that we've talked about climbing to, for example, Mount Kinabalu, which is, as we mentioned, at a lower altitude, but still pretty high?
Yes. My last Kinabalu climb was about a month back. And every time I climbed, I always observed people complaining of headache. This is at Laban Rata, at altitude of about 3,000 meters. Most of them would attribute this to just, you know, having climbed the whole day and they get headache. But actually, it's very classic mild acute mountain sickness. It's just underdiagnosed. And of course, the treatment is very simple because it's mild. It's just Panadol. So I do see this. And Laban Rata is 3,000 meters. It's just a level that you can get acute mountain sickness.
So what then are the health markers that as a doctor you were monitoring among people as they were climbing?
Yeah. If I were to make it simple, sometimes if you climb, you will see these signboards saying, don't vomit on the mountain and die. So vomiting is a very dangerous sign because a simple headache is fine. But when you start to vomit, that is a marker that your acute mountain sickness is rather severe. And that is the best simple marker for you to make decision that you should not climb up further until your symptoms are resolved, or even go down till your symptoms are resolved.
When do you know that someone needs to turn back and descend? This can, of course, be a very hard decision because most people train. You know, most people are dreaming of this moment, but then you have to say, look, this is just not your time.
Yes, the vomiting is one of those symptoms. The worst symptoms would be having shortness of breath because that may point towards you having watery lung. Also, when you start to have abnormal behavior, hallucinating, abnormal behavior. An example of abnormal behavior up there, it's very cold. This we noticed on one of our climbers. He opens the shirt when it's cold and saying that it's hot. So it's very abnormal behavior. This is pointing towards a watery brain, and worse when one has a coma up there. Of course, there are, we say, the differentials. I mean, it's not caused by the acute mountain sickness. For example, someone is having asthmatic attack up there. It may be an asthma attack, but it may also be the watery lung. We had one climber, not from our group, who actually died the next day because he thought he had an asthmatic attack, just used some puff. So when we're not sure, we go to the worst of possibilities, and to be safe, we descend down and then climb up again when we are all right.
Finally, what message would you like to leave us with on the subject of both emergency medicine at high altitudes and what it was like for you to have been a doctor providing care, you know, at base camp of Everest? Because that's something that I think very few people will get to experience.
I was very grateful and lucky to experience both sides of the routes to Mount Everest from both south and north. The south route was through Nepal and the north route through Tibet. And along the way, I saw all these symptoms, the acute mountain sickness, the high altitude cerebral edema, high altitude pulmonary edema. In fact, there were also people who had stroke up there, and in fact, people who had heart attack up there. So not to mention all kinds of common illnesses, all this diarrhea, flu, fever. So if one is to climb up there, the first is to prevent and avoid getting sick. And how you could avoid getting sick is to observe your hygiene. When you climb, don't climb too fast. Enjoy the journey rather than being too obsessed to get to the destination. So take your time, because that would be worth it. Apart from enjoying the scenery, the journey, you'll be better acclimatized up there. And number two, you have to be aware of the signs and symptoms of acute mountain sickness. It may save your life, because if you do not observe these symptoms and they progress to the extreme end, it may be costly and deadly. As simple as having a headache, beware when you start to vomit, or when you have abnormal behavior, or you're having shortness of breath. These are the signs and symptoms for you to watch out. If you're just having a headache, you can just rest at the same altitude. But when you start having vomiting and other symptoms, you should consider going down where the oxygen is more, and when you have no more symptoms, then you can reattempt to climb up.
Before I let you go, something that just occurred to me while you were speaking was this expedition is fairly recent, but Everest itself was first conquered, you know, in 1953. Were all these different types of sicknesses and medications and the need for a doctor, for example, were these already known back then? You know, has emergency medicine at high altitudes, has it evolved? Has it changed over the years? Or is it actually much the same as when we saw Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, you know, kind of reach that peak?
It changed. What we knew about acute mountain sickness started to occur even more recent times. Even though we knew about it in a couple of decades ago, not many are aware of this situation, this illness and the medications. The climbers themselves take it to themselves to take Dimox, for example, the esterzolamide on their own. So these are rather more recent development. In fact, there are more research going on in terms of what medications to take up there. We've seen multiple approaches in terms of drug use. Some people nowadays using steroids even before they climb in the form of dexamethasone with good results. Some people are taking ginkgo biloba. Even some people are taking Viagra. Apparently, it helped a bit, according to the ones who took it, but I'm not sure. But still, for us doctors, we stick to what has been working in the past in the form of esterzolamide, steroids, and simple painkiller, things like that.
And you saved the Viagra for something entirely different. Thank you very much for coming in. I've been speaking today with Dr. Alzamani Idris, consultant emergency physician. We've been discussing emergency medicine at high altitudes. You've been listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.